Centennial is special as Wyoming is special. There is all this space, the sky and the openness, and then the independent characters that live here and come through here.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. In this episode, we're taking a look at the mythical heart of the cowboy state, ranching. And although ranching is not Wyoming's main economic driver, the cowboy is central to the state's identity and culture. In Wyoming, many ranching families have been raising beef cattle for generations. Cowboys are born here and raised learning the trade. But on the other side of the world, Russia has never had a beef industry. In an effort to limit food imports and build up food security, the government there has been generously helping companies with loans and subsidies to establish beef operations. The companies have set up ranches and imported beef cows and technology, but one thing they could not import was the workforce, the cowboy. Irina Zhorov takes us to a Russian rodeo where fledgling cowboys are trying to prove that producing beef domestically is possible.
I'm on a farm in Bryansk, about 300 miles southwest of Moscow. Everything on this farm looks brand new, because it is. The farm is just a year old, and the tractors, the administrative buildings, the gravel work roads, the fencing, somehow even the cows themselves, sparkle. As far as rodeos go, everything here is similar to an American rodeo, except a little different. The cowboys enter the arena to patriotic songs, just like in the U.S., but here, one song is about how America should return Alaska to Russia. Another is about Russia's untapped mightiness. Give me a horse and a sword. No swords here, but plenty of horses, and tons of people who've come to watch. They've brought signs, and they cheer for their teams as they struggle to rope steers in the arena. Watching the proceedings is Sean Weeks. He says in the U.S., rodeo started as friendly competition between ranches.
Well, my cowboys are better than your cowboys. My horses are better than your horses. And so it kind of was the same idea here.
Except here, one company owns all the competing farms, Muratorg. Weeks is one of a handful of American contractors currently working on Muratorg farms. He's like the most cowboy I've ever met.
I'm actually a fourth-generation cowboy. That's my family history.
As we talk, his horse chews hay nearby, and he throws a rope around a dummy bull, casually practicing his lasso skills.
I grew up doing this, you know. A rope was actually my first toy.
Before he reached his teen years, he was putting in hours as a ranch hand. He's got a great big mustache and wears Western boots, a hat, and a tucked-in button-up shirt. When Muratorg hired him 2 years ago, he carried on his saddle, made by his dad, on the flight over. Muratorg started acquiring land in 2010, most of it fallow fields abandoned when the Soviet Union fell apart. Shortly after, Muratorg started populating that land with thousands of cows, flown or shipped in from places like the U.S. In the U.S., it took more than 100 years of breeding to make animals specifically for beef. Russia has only had dairy cows, which don't make good meat. By bringing in fine-tuned genetics, the Russians skipped a huge step in building up a herd.
I've never seen anything grow this fast, ever. And sometimes it kind of sets me back a little bit, like, whoa, let's slow this train down a little bit. But this is their, you know, this is their program, and this is what they want, so I just try to help them the best I can.
By copying the structure of Western beef operations, Muratorg is single-handedly trying to create an American-style beef industry, but in a very condensed time period. It now has about 400,000 cows, the largest herd in the world. The company has had to build fences in a country without any, to train veterinarians, and to also import everything from horses and grass seed to tractors. But the hardest part of managing this immense operation is not the science or the planning. It's finding workers. Cowboys. And that's where Weeks comes in. His job is teaching locals to cowboy. The new hires, mostly young men from nearby villages, have no experience. Most of them have only seen cowboys in black and white movies.
The difference is they're starting out from scratch. There's only a handful of us here to try to teach all these people how to do this.
Muratorg now employs 1,000 Russian cowboys. They call them operators, though. Yep, operators. They've managed to make cowboys sound bureaucratic. Week says it's been hard translating cowboy work ethic and skills to the operators. For example, last summer, he got a call asking him to come help out in a herding emergency.
And they said, we need you to come and move these steers because we tried to move them and it was a bad deal.
So he gets there and starts rounding up the 600 steers, and everything seems to be going just fine.
And I thought, man, I just don't see what the problem is, other than maybe they got going a little fast yesterday. And
then he approaches the gate, and the animals become nervous.
All of a sudden, I hear this chi-ching, chi-ching, and I, what in the world? And I turn around trying to find this sound. Here comes two guys riding over the hill behind us on bicycles with the little handlebar bells on them. They thought they were going to help us move these steers with these bicycles.
These particular operators wouldn't ride horses, so they tried using bikes to herd the cows.
You know, I hate to admit it, but if they learned how to do things right, they could do it. But I'm not going to tell them that. I want cowboys.
If you're going to replicate the beef system, you might as well get all the parts right, he says. And what's a proper cowboy that can't show off at a rodeo? The announcer reviews scores for the teams, and Weeks looks out at his operators, steely-eyed.
They can do better than that, and they know it, and I know it too.
I go wander the grounds. I find steak cooking demonstrations, information on how the farm works, cows to pet. It's like one big advertisement for beef. In the U.S., a steak starts with a calf that spends about a year on pasture, proceeds to a feedlot, then a processing facility, then a store or restaurant. Each step is its own industry with myriad players. Because none of that has existed in Russia, Muratorg encompasses all of those sectors under one giant roof and has had to build them up along with the ranches. Hence the cooking demos. They kind of have to train steak eaters, too. Back in the arena, a team called Mglin rides out to a relatively toned-down folk song. People in the stands chant to encourage them. It takes an operator named Yevgeny Landik several tries, but he finally ropes the steer. He looked nervous angling up to the calf, but afterwards, he says he wasn't.
The American taught us that we have to take it just like a work. So that's what I did. I just went out as if to work and did my job and left. That's all. Nothing to worry about. You just have to show them how you work in the field.
He's one of Muratorg's up-and-coming operators, young, quiet, serious. He's wearing a floral silk kerchief around his neck. The company gave the operators kerchiefs with traditional Russian designs on them for the rodeo. They're a Russian take on the silk bandanas American cowboys wear, just like the operators are the Russians' take on cowboys.
Russian cowboys impatient. They got uncontrollable passion. Once a Russian cowboy gets impatient, there is nothing to stop him. That's how we are. The Russians are like, hurry, hurry, faster. I'll get him first. Come on, come on.
Landik gets back on his horse for the next event. I know he's not talking about Muratorg's business plan, but I can't help but draw a parallel as he talks. Hurry, hurry, faster, faster. In a kind of throwback to the Soviets' penchant for ambitious plans, Muratorg's proposal calls for doubling the number of their farms and cows. It's a big investment, and they haven't turned a profit yet. They started selling meat 2 years ago, but beef doesn't sell that well, at least in part because it's so expensive in Russia. Perhaps measuring success instead starts with a man named Sergei Shilin. He's the company's most convincing operator.
I try to approximate the American cowboy.
Shillin has on a hat given to him by an American when he caught his first steer by the hind legs. Another American gifted him the boots he's wearing for working well together. He's from a nearby village and used to work at a dairy operation, which fell apart. He says he thought he knew cows, but his first day at Muratorg as an operator was difficult.
Right away, they give me a horse. It was an American horse. I couldn't control the same way as the Russian horses. Not knowing how to work with them, I got two bulls stressed out, and we needed to transfer them section to section. The bulls came at me. It was hard.
His wife made him go back the next day, and he progressed quickly from there. After 2 years as an operator, he took a job as a trainer. Now he teaches riding and roping skills at a recently opened cowboy academy. Sounds official, right? A whole academy to train operators because they're hiring so many, so fast, and it's all just so, so new. Shillin, of course, loves it.
For me, this is becoming a lifestyle. At the current time, this cowboy work is real lifestyle. I cherish it, God willing them. My son grows up, and I want him to be a Russian cowboy, too. He's 4 months old right now. In the near future, I want him to be a cowboy as well.
The rodeo is winding down. In the arena, the participants receive their prizes, about $100 to buy Western wear. That might be a little hard because there's nowhere locally to buy it. And then, there's one more surprise.
There's parachutists coming down.
Parachutists, who the DJs call aerial cowboys, float down into the arena with Russian flags and Muratorg flags. The foreigners are in awe.
That was a little bit close.
That was a little close.
All this for some steaks. But of course, the steaks are so much more than that. A symbol of success, of Russia's ability to take care of its own. So how are the steaks anyway? Shillin says he doesn't know.
To tell you the truth, I haven't ever tried the steak yet. I have never tried the meat.
Why not, I ask?
To tell you the truth, I just haven't had a chance. And especially the marble steaks. For me, for now, it's too expensive, and I can afford to buy a kilo of this meat. I think in the future, I will try it with my family.
So, for now, a Russian cowboy is also one who doesn't eat steak.
Back in Wyoming, guest ranches, or dude ranches, have given tourists a taste of the cowboy lifestyle for decades. In Grand Teton National Park, the White Grass Dude Ranch entertained visitors who came for mountain views and the chance to play cowboy. It closed in 1985, and soon the ranch's cabins and lodge started falling apart. That's how White Grass joined a backlog of some 27,000 historic properties nationwide that the National Park Service couldn't afford to maintain. But things have changed. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Huntington attended a recent rope cutting to celebrate the ranch's revival.
At the event celebrating the complete rehab of 13 rustic cabins at White Grass, Barb Paul of the National Trust for Historic Preservation said she almost couldn't believe the ranch survived.
The first time I saw this place, it looked quite different than the way it looks today. And White Grass, along with many other historic structures in the park, had suffered from years of deferred maintenance and was severely deteriorating. In fact, many of you remember, probably felt that it really was too far gone to be brought back to this wonderful condition.
Paul said efforts to rescue the ranch started 13 years ago. That's when then-Interior Secretary Gail Norton signed an agreement with the Trust President Richard Moe to rescue the ranch. The Park Service has spent about $2 million, while the Trust chipped in another $1 million to restore the cabins. The main lodge and guest cabins sit scattered along the edge of a grassy meadow, where wildlife still freely roam at the foot of the Teton Mountains. Homesteaded in 1913, White Grass capitalized on this magnificent setting, switching from raising cattle to entertaining dudes, or those from outside the West, which was more profitable. Catherine Watson is the director of the Western Center for Historic Preservation, now based at Whitegrass. She says it will now be a model training ground, where people can come learn how to do the same kind of restoration for other historic properties throughout the West.
And we're really the only center doing this on what we call traditionally built resources. So things like log cabins. Our range is so large. We work from Alaska down to Hawaii.
Wood Chips Fly is volunteer Jack Schinkle uses an axe and chisel to carve a saddle-shaped notch into a log.
All of these cabins, well, most all of them used the round notch in the corners, and this is how they made the notches to fit.
It's just the kind of skill that will be taught here. Watson says Whitegrass's resurrection marks a symbolic shift away from Park Service policies of the 1980s and 90s that favored letting buildings decay to restore natural landscapes.
So this has been a total shift in Park Service management, not just in this park, but in a lot of large Western quote-unquote natural parks, to really bring cultural resources to an equal footing with the natural resources.
Grand Teton National Park Superintendent David Vela agrees.
I don't frankly buy the notion that we have historical parks and natural parks. We have resource-rich parks that have cultural values and natural values.
But he says that doesn't mean you can save every structure.
Because we have close to 700 historic assets in the park. And if it were up to me, that we would preserve and protect every single one of them, because every one of them has a unique story. But that's not the reality. So the reality is we have to look at which assets provide the greatest level and opportunity of preservation and protection, but also that provide a representative sample of the stories.
And Whitegrass has plenty of stories. Beth Thomas Wooden first came to Whitegrass as a guest when she was 8 years old in 1954. She returned often and eventually went from being a guest to working as a wrangler.
Oh, I loved it. That was my life ambition, was to be a wrangler at Whitegrass. So.
Once she started working summers at the ranch, Wooden invited her childhood friend from Philadelphia, Olivia Meeks, to join her.
When Bethy and I came out here, we weren't even in a cabin. We were in a tent up in those woods. And that was in the day when the park didn't really have strong rules about bears and dumps. And so there we were up in that tent, and there was a dump down there that was frequented by a bear.
And we were near the kitchen. That was the worst. Because the bears would come to the kitchen, and they had to go by our tent to get to the kitchen.
Yeah, it was kind of wild and woolly.
Meigs even met her husband here. Just one of the many romances that made Whitegrassers, as they call themselves, fall in love with the place and want to save it. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Huntington in Jackson.
Now, cattle may be king, but it isn't the only type of livestock on the range. Wyoming's sheep industry relies on foreign labor from the Department of Labor's H-2A visa program, which applies to agricultural jobs. When that agency raised wage requirements for sheep herders in 2015, ranchers complained that the rule change could put them out of business. But workers' advocates argued that the new regulations were not enough. Wyoming Public Radio's Alana Elder met with a rancher and a shepherd just after the latest round of raises went into effect.
Wyoming's sheep industry relies on foreign labor from the Department of Labor's H-2A visa program, which applies to agricultural jobs. When that agency raised wage requirements for sheep herders in 2015, ranchers complained that the rule change could put them out of business. But workers' advocates argued that the new regulations were not enough. Wyoming Public Radio's Alana Elder met with a rancher and a shepherd near Kemmer just after the latest round of raises went into effect.
Rancher Bill Talliver drove me to a one-room house raised on blocks. A pair of voices and two pairs of boots let out from underneath it. Talliver's son-in-law and 44-year-old herder Lorenzo Salazar had been trying to fix a plumbing problem. Salazar tells me it's been cold lately and that his pipes froze that morning. Because of all the snow that's fallen, he hasn't had much to do with herding sheep. Salazar has worked for the Tallivers on and off for 14 years, and even with the cold and the solitude, he says he likes the work. He sends most of his paycheck home to his wife and four children who are all in school. Since last year's raise, he's had an easier time meeting the family's expenses. Tolliver plans on hiring two more shepherds in the spring, but he worries that he and other ranchers will have trouble covering their costs if lamb prices don't go up. Wyoming sheep producers earn some income from wool production, but they mostly depend on selling lambs to feedlots or slaughterhouses. Prices for both of those commodities have been slumping for a long time, and people have been shrinking their herds.
We used to run 14,000 head of sheep on the open range, and we can't do it anymore.
The family is scaling back and looking for new ways to make money. Tolliver plans to keep using the H-2A program, but he sees the new regulations as part of a shift that's coming in the industry, driving ranchers to switch to on-farm flocks of a couple hundred sheep, which they can raise without herders.
But then you have to have wheat or corn or something else to sell because the lambs from 200 aren't going to keep a family alive for a year. The industry is just going to change, and if you can't make money doing something, maybe you go to recreation, or if you have to, you sell a ranch.
It seems counterintuitive to sort of subsidize the ranches that are not as efficient and therefore believe themselves to be unable to pay their workers a reasonable wage.
That's Nina DeSalvo, a lawyer with the Denver-based firm Towards Justice. She says that since domestic shepherds in states like Maine and North Dakota have earned between $10 and $12 an hour, Western ranchers should be paying more. DeSalvo's representing shepherds in four separate lawsuits, including a case against the DOL over the recent rule changes. The H-2A program has a separate set of regulations for range jobs because herders can spend months without access to running water or electricity. And ranchers say that since shepherds are on call for 24 hours a day while looking after sheep, it's just not feasible to pay them an hourly wage. So this most recent set of special procedures for sheep, goat, and livestock herding set shepherd salaries at minimum wage for a 48-hour work week. DeSalvo says the DOL is out of line because that's much less than the workers she represents actually work. Towards Justice is also suing the Department of Homeland Security, which issues the visas. Herders are allowed to stay in the U.S. for 3 years before they have to reapply, and that's longer than the standard for most H-2A workers.
They purport to create an H-2A visa for shepherds that is meant to bring foreign labor into this country to meet a permanent labor shortage, whereas the H-2A program itself was created to address temporary or seasonal labor shortages.
DeSalvo says that distinction matters because herders would benefit from permanent visas available through other programs.
They would be able to bring their families, they would be able to establish their lives, and not always be in sort of a strange, fluctuating, transient visa status.
The way she sees it, the permanent labor shortage exists because wages have been so low for so long. Last year's raise was the first shepherds had seen in nearly two decades, and DeSalvo says that stagnation has scared Americans out of herding jobs.
There just aren't any. There aren't any more. Because they make, like, between $2 and $4 an hour.
Rancher Tolliver agrees that there aren't Americans applying to be shepherds, but instead of wages, he blames the tough conditions of the job and a changing culture.
It's tough to find young Mexicans who want to come over. I mean, they like to go to the movies, and they want to be in town on Saturday night. And just like my grandkids, hell, they don't want to be out there stuck in the sheep wagon. But I guess they don't need the work.
Shepherd Salazar says he does need the work. In the spring, he'll head out onto the range, and he won't be back for 7 months. He tells me he first learned to herd sheep near El Paso, Texas, and after so much time working for the Tollivers, he knows everything about this job. For now, ranchers will have to pay more for that expertise. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Alana Elder.
Wyoming's open range is fodder for many a story, so let's hear firsthand from some Wyomingites with ranching roots. Roy Chambers was born to Ida and Andy Chambers in 1924 in a log cabin still standing on Mormon Row in the shadow of the Tetons in what's now Grand Teton National Park. Roy worked hard on the family's homestead cattle ranch. He met his wife Becky, a nurse at St. John's Hospital, and they married in 1956. 2 years later, they bought the Flying V Ranch, today known as the Grovant River Ranch, and went into the dude ranching business. Roy talks about the joys of running a guest ranch with Rob Cheek, who first came to Jackson Hole as a teenage dude or tourist.
But I just love the Dude Ranch. I wish I'd have been 10 years younger, because those people were so terrific, and I had so much fun with them. I never did figure them big guests. They were more or less friends, and it was hell when we finally had to sail.
Where did most of your dudes come from?
Oh, well, all over the country, Germany, Japan, England, Washington, D.C., all over the United States. My wife put a deal together. If I hadn't had her, it was wonderful when I finally got a hold of a woman. I'll tell you, she wasn't going to have any pleasant life. But I really did luck in, because her mother was so nervous that she'd come out and she just didn't know what to do. And finally I said, hire her. So we hired her mother. And that was it until we got done running the Dude Ranch, and she cooked for the men at the ranch. And then we had her laundry down there, and she'd help the girls and show them how to launder. And it was just heaven. I didn't need to worry about the ranch cook or anything. And she just took all the stress, you know, out of having to be down there. You could have more fun riding with a bunch of dudes if you take every question they ever ask you and figure out how to answer it. And, you know, this BS and boat dudes, you don't do that. Those people are too smart. I mean, they wouldn't be dumb if they had money enough to come to our place. And so I got so that off the top of my head, I knew 32 flowers. I know the name of every tree. And they get into the birds. Now, I'd said, now look, there's a limit to my knowledge, and by God, I'm not a bird man. And, oh, we would have more fun on our trips. It was really funny one day. This couple come in, and they said, we don't ride. And I said, you don't have to. And they would eat in the morning, and they'd take a lunch, and they'd go off walking for about 2 days. And the next day, they sit around the campground, and they heard those dudes talk about what they'd been doing that day. And it sounds so interesting. She says, well, could I ride? And I says, you certainly can if you want to. Well, she rode, and she listened that day at all the spiels and everything, and she come back. She said, you know, that was a history lesson. And I couldn't believe it. So her husband got to riding. And, we just had more fun on those trails than anything. We made it interesting. And my son got to be in just like I was.
I'm Rob Cheek. I first came in the Valley in 1951 as a child, dude, with my parents. My grandmother had a place in Moose called the Moose Bell Ranch. And then I visited out here often and finally moved out here in 1975 and have been here ever since.
Well, I'm Roy Chambers, an old cattle rancher. I come here in 1924 and lit on the bed of where my mother was when she was pregnant, and I was the last child of our family out of seven that was born in that log cabin.
Down in southern Wyoming, Frank, Bert, and Bob Johnson grew up on the A1 ranch outside the little town of Elk Mountain, named for the nearby peak towering over the town. The three brothers remember childhood troublemaking on the ranch and in the schoolhouse.
We all three went to school at the ranch, didn't have any school. Too far to go to school, so we had the school teacher stay with us.
And that four ranch kids out there that really had a lot of fun with some of these school teachers, because one of them was just a young lady, and she got scared walking over to the schoolhouse one day because she saw something move under the sidewalk, and the wind was blowing a feather. We thought, well, gee, if she's that afraid, well, maybe we ought to arrange so she can see a mouse every now and then, you know, or something, because we had a real easy afternoon. So she saw quite a few mice then, and I think she lasted 6 months. One of our aunts, my dad's sister, Dorothy, was teaching school there, and so we decided it'd be a good idea. Back in those days, we could get these firecrackers about 2.5 inches long, and they loaded into a big can of sulfur. And they used it to scare the coyotes away. They'd go off about every 10, 15 minutes. So we had an ample supply of 2.5 inch firecrackers. So we got some dynamite fuse, and we fixed our own little blow-up thing, and we put it under the schoolhouse and ran the fuse up through the crack in the rocks, you know. And Aunt Dorothy rang the bell, and by gollies, we all ran in. And about 5 minutes, she always read a story right after the noon lunch hour. She always read a story, so we was sitting there reading a story, and all of a sudden, just happened to be under her desk, firecracker went off. And she jumped, we started laughing, and then another one went off, and she jumped, and that was the end of the story. She never read any more that day. We had a test that afternoon for some reason. I can't remember why. Well, I remember one time when we was kids, you know, we had a lot of fun and had a great big old truck tire, and we worked half a day to get it pushed away up the big hill there, and said, okay, who's going to get in and ride it? Oh, yeah. I was too big. I was a little heavy at the time. So we talked Bert into getting inside that. And we'll turn the tire loose, and here's Bertie going down the hill inside this big truck tire. It would have been all right, except the truck tire hit the side of the barn and bounced back about 20 feet. It was going pretty good. And fell over on the side. And we come running down the hill, and Bert was still inside the tire. It took him probably 5 minutes or more to get out of that tire and knock you silly. That's probably what's wrong with him now.
On the other side of the mountain range, Nita Engen grew up in Centennial. She's the fifth generation of ranchers to own land in the area, and she cherishes the community that raised her as a child. So here are a few of her childhood memories from the range.
Centennial is special as Wyoming is special. There is all this space, the sky and the openness, and then the independent characters that live here and come through here. Our lifestyle, which is mostly outdoors, where we have access to the Rocky Mountains and to the High Plains. As young children, we had such independence, but we also had responsibility. We roamed far and wide. We all went to a one-room schoolhouse, so there was a lot of interaction up and down the age groups. As so often happens, the school and the school programs were the center of the social universe for the community. This brought together the families of the business owners, the ranchers, the lumbermen, and the Forest Service. All of those families came together. Our parents taught us to celebrate life and the seasons and the natural wonder that surrounded us. So just to start with like what the annual cycle was, it was really fun. Easter was often quite cold, but Clara Hushman, who lived in the house straight across there, would paint Easter eggs for us, and we would have a fabulous Easter egg hunt. Halloween was something else again. The party alternated between the Centennial School, our one-room schoolhouse, and the Buckeye School. So the parents had this rivalry and this pride on who could have the scariest party. In my opinion, definitely the Buckeye School won because they put the haunted house in the barn next to the school, which was unbelievably frightening for young children. But then our mother ended up being a dead witch in a coffin as you came in the door of the Centennial School, which scared the heck out of all of us. And we didn't even know that was our mother, so she was pretty effectively disguised. Following the party in Centennial Valley, we would get in station wagons and go down to George and Roberta Krause's home to trick and treat. And George would put sheets on his cows, so they had ghost cows as we went up to George and Roberta's house. So in the summer, we had fishing with my hands under the rocks. And on these different irrigation ditches along the North Fork River here, there's all these little pools and all these big rocks where the fish will go in and nest. And as young children, you don't have a big profile or whatever. You can sit there and you have nothing to do but wait. And then you just would wait and grab them, especially at the head gates, because they would pool and you could get this whole gaggle of fish. And it was very funny. It wasn't until I was an adult that I ever fished with a pole. And then there was 4-H, and 4-H was a big event here for all of us ranch kids in the valley. One of the fun stories is that my sister has this huge heart, and every animal that she was supposed to take care of became her pet. So when she was little, she had this sheep called Spot. And Spot was like, he was one of those tall Hampshire sheep. And that sheep followed her around like a dog. It was always a problem. Like when the family got in the car to go somewhere, the sheep would be running after the car to come with or whatever. And she used to ride the sheep. And, you know, we used to like hook the wagon or, you know, some kind of buggy on the back of the sheep, and Robin would go for a ride in it or whatever. It was hysterical. In the fall, there were turkey shoots. In the winter, there was skiing up at Medicine Bow, sledding and ice skating. It seemed that wherever there was a sheet of ice, there would be a gaggle of kids ice skating. And our parents, there were the bonfire and hot cocoa to keep us warm. I had this magical childhood, and we had so much freedom compared to what children have today. We walked and rode our bikes everywhere. Nobody had to worry about anything. It was really nice. So some young people that I know now, they talk and they complain about how the rate of change in Wyoming is so slow, in which I consider such a positive, because I have lived on the East Coast, where I lived in this area that was like farming land, and you go back like 10 years later and it's completely built up and suburbs and shopping centers and everything. And I make a joke that in the time that I have been away, so it was probably like 30 years, there was like one additional stoplight added in Laramie. So kind of like the community has changed a lot, and yet it hasn't changed. So there are a lot more people here. There are people here that would rather have it be a suburb than, you know, a rural community or whatever. But the spirit of the community hasn't changed. I travel quite a bit, and I go to these different places, and this is unique. We should not take for granted that every community is like this, because it is really special.
All of those memories are part of our series Wyoming Stories, and you can find more of them at our new website, themodernwest.org. That's it for this edition of The Modern West. You can hear our next episode on the third Tuesday of the month. In the meantime, if you have a moment, leave a rating or review on iTunes to help other people find the show. Sam Egan produced the podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.